What's up, fools? This is the QTR podcast. Just to let everybody know, it's going to be a long one if I can't even put that sentence together. This podcast is brought to you by Series7Podcast.com. Successful investing is a result of experience, education, and luck. You can't rush experience, you can't control luck, but you can acquire yourself an education. If you ever go to work in the financial services industry, you may be required to pass the Series 7. This exam covers the material financial professionals are required to master before they can talk to the general public about investments. But this knowledge should not only be for financial professionals. My friend Franz at Series7Podcast.com has put together an audio course to help financial professionals and individual investors master the material for the Series 7. This material covers the full gamut of financial products and regulations, including the various equities such as common, preferred, and convertible stocks, fixed income securities, closed and open-end mutual funds, warrants, options, defined contribution, and defined benefit retirement plans, and on, and pretty much everything. And the nice thing is Franz lets you try before you buy, so you can get 5 free sample lessons by visiting his website, series7podcast.com. That's series and then the number 7, podcast.com, and signing up for the free sample lessons and related quizzes, or just subscribe to his podcast and download the lessons. The full course is 58 audio lessons, which is over 25 hours of audio instruction and over 1,100 online quiz questions. If you want to purchase the $99.99 lessons and quizzes bundle before July 1st, you can get $10 off by using the offer code RAVEN, R-A-V-E-N, in all lowercase, at checkout. So you can learn more at Series 7, that's series, the number 7, podcast.com. And that's actually... It's a pretty cool idea. It's not often I read the sponsorship thing and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. But it's interesting to think that you don't need to be going into the financial industry to just know the basics that you would need to pass the Series 7. And I would be lying if I said I didn't go and look at sample tests of the Series 7 and the Series 63 a while back, and also like sample tests for the CFA test, just to see what I knew and what I didn't know. So, if you're interested, check it out. Check out Series7Podcast.com. Okay. that's Matt Stewart introducing himself right there. So today on the podcast, I got Matt Stewart. If you guys don't know who Matt Stewart is, I'm going to read you his bio as he's written it, and then I'm going to tell you his bio as I know it. Matt Stewart's a private investor. He's a former vice president and director of RBC Dominion Securities Incorporated in Toronto. And he holds an honors BA from the University of Western Ontario and an MBA from the F.W. Olin School of Business at Babson College. I think Mark Cahotas is also a Babson College alumnus. Matt also represented all BCE common shareholders as the intervener in the BCE versus bondholders case argued before the Supreme Court of Canada in July 2008. Now, I met Matt Stewart when I started to do work on Herbalife. And Matt had been very prolific in writing about Herbalife, not so much lately. And I love reading Matt's stuff. It's, you know, he knows what he's talking about. He's an extremely smart guy, and he's got a quick wit, too. So if you want to go back and read some of his articles, they're on Seeking Alpha under Matt Stewart. I'm trying to get Matt to write a little bit more. But I met Matt probably 3 or 4 years ago for the first time. And we've just been corresponding over the phone for the last couple years, talking about Herbalife and how we just nailed that one, right, Matt?
Yeah, it's nice to be here. I've been told I have a great face for radio, so this is a good format.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Matt Stewart. Thank you very much for coming on, Matt. We appreciate it. So, Matt, why don't you tell me how you got involved with the Herbalife thing and. Because again, so you got like something like 203 articles here on Seeking Alpha that you've written about Herbalife negatively. All the while, the stock has gone from, 28 to 111. So why don't you talk about, and I've been right there with you alongside you writing critically about it. I mean, we both obviously thought Ackman was right. At least on the facts, I still think he is. On the trade, not so much. How'd you get involved?
I think the simplest way to explain it is, as with anybody else, you're constantly looking in the marketplace for good investment ideas. And a lot of portfolio managers are very discreet with their ideas and keep them private, and other activist shareholders often evangelize their ideas. And by paying attention to the world of professional investing, you can often piggyback on a lot of the homework and due diligence that these people do, and have mountains of money and resources to throw behind their ideas. So when Pershing Square made their initial presentation, Shane Dineen and Bill and company, I was intrigued by the idea. I was intrigued by the thesis. I was intrigued by the fact that it was a short position. And the story itself caught my attention, mostly because of its societal impact, or the social narrative that went along with the investment thesis. So I started digging in and reading and doing my own due diligence, and thought that Pershing Square was onto something.
Yeah, but you're not, like, Matt, I know you're not just some social justice warrior. I mean, you have a really thorough background in finance, so you had to know, look, this company is spouting off a ton of cash at 80% margins also, at the same time, which ultimately I think was its saving grace, right, going forward. Did you consider that right from the get-go?
Well, I think there's an undeniable truth that pyramid schemes or forms thereof throw extraordinary amounts of free cash flow. And, you know, the observation that I had was the reason they do that is they basically have a source of labor that is effectively free. What I mean by that is when you're churning 2 million people through your distributor base per annum, most of whom are failing, those economic losses subsidize the bottom line. As long as those churn rates are able to persist, the company is going to continue to throw off what I would call super rates of return on capital.
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit, Matt. I don't know if it's your phone or what, but
yeah.
Anyways.
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, from the get-go, it's not a case, though, where, like, you saw Ackman's presentation and you were just like, you know, I'm going to look at this and I'm going to go in on the trade without looking at it myself, right? Because that, you know, that's something that I wrote at one point on Twitter was, the best part about the Herbalife short case is that Ackman did a lot of the heavy lifting for everybody. In that first presentation, which I clearly thought was his best and laid out the case in the most calculated fashion, said a lot of, you know, it's a very complex thing, these companies. There are a lot of bits and pieces to these multi-level marketing companies. There's jargon. It's a very complex structure. And I thought he did a very good job of tearing the whole thing down. And that's what I meant by it. I didn't mean that I hadn't looked at it myself. And of course, you know, with the stock at $111, John Hempton is ridiculing me on Twitter, and that's fine. But I want to ask you about you. I mean, you said Ackman's research was good. I agree with you, but you looked at it yourself too, right?
Yeah, I did a lot of reading on the law. You know, a lot of that was work that had been done by Pershing Square and Mr. Clafter and his department. But a lot of it was publicly available, and it became clear to me that the way the company was behaving was clearly analogous to them behaving like an outlaw. You know, they were not complying with the law as it was written. And so that was true. It's still true. it was proven to be true. Obviously, the government took action against them. The central failure of the investment thesis was the idea that they would be permanently shut down. Obviously, that wasn't the case. Obviously, the jurisdiction that acted was the United States. The company's business around the world has been able to continue to function the way it has probably historically for the most part.
But Matt, your thesis from the get-go was never that that the company had to be shut down completely for the investment to work, right?
No, I think probably the most surprising thing for me, and I don't know, what are we, 5-6 years into this thing? The most surprising thing for me has been the company's ability to continue to recruit 2 million new people per annum. I mean, the size of the pyramid, or whatever you want to call it, the sales force, has not grown over time. It's still flatlining around 4 million members. The company doesn't disclose that number anymore in its 10Qs and 10K, which is obviously nefarious behavior on their part. But, you know, when you look at the quarterly disclosures on the number of distributors they're recruiting, you look at the fact that the revenue line has effectively been flatlining, you know, you can back your way into a conclusion that there's still extraordinary amounts of churn in the business model, and its sustainability is dependent upon recruiting.
So what's the disconnect? Where did we get wrong? You know, did we get it wrong assuming that the company wasn't going to be able to recruit and continue to churn through as many people as it has now that so much, you know, quote unquote, sunlight has been shown on the business model? Or do you think there's some other reason? Do you think there's something else going on? Because when I was talking to Jason Jones on the podcast about this, there's certain things that just don't make sense to me. When they made all the rule changes in Mexico and there wasn't really a blip on the radar in Mexico's, in really any of the metrics in the Mexican business, that just didn't make sense to me. For me, and I discussed this with Jason a little bit, I mean, for me, one of the craziest things is that there is this line of people that continues to churn through the business. So it's, and the longer it goes on, the stranger it gets. I mean, look, maybe I'm just inherently misinformed about how multi-level marketing schemes work. And, you know, there's a saying, there's a sucker born every minute, right? But given the amount of bad publicity that the company has faced, and I don't know, it just doesn't make sense to me that they're able to still churn through the same amount of people. I mean, where do you feel like we got that wrong, if we got it wrong?
Well, I think you quoted P.T. Barnum, who also said every crowd has a silver lining, right? I mean, it's I think the one thing that is an important lesson to take away from this is, you know, anybody who studied economics knows that, you know, an underlying assumption of most economic models is that people in the marketplaces that are being studied act rationally, right? Well, I think Herbalife is living proof that as a species, human beings are decidedly irrational animals and will continue to behave irrationally, whether or not you hammer them with a sophisticated dialectic Socratic argument to the contrary. So that's probably mistake number one. I think mistake number two is obviously what you referred to, which is the resiliency of the recruiting algorithm. Probably mistake number three was something that Carl Icahn, I think, latched onto very early. I think if you look back at his comments publicly on the company, he said he consulted with an FTC lawyer very early on in the process, and that the advice he received from that attorney was that while the government may in fact discipline the company, it's very unlikely that they're going to shut them down. And so he obviously ran with that football and scored a touchdown. So you know, those sorts of things in the narrative were obviously you know, different outcomes. And I think that the final one is another important idea to consider, is that and I'll use the analogy of a boxing match. You know, you may be able to throw a tremendous right hook, which, let's call that the initial Pershing Square presentation, but don't assume that your opponent isn't going to counterpunch. And, you know, both the company itself and the investors who were on, the professional investors who ended up on the other side of the trade, turned out to be incredibly aggressive opponents, you know. So it's not good enough, I guess, at the end of the day, just to be morally right in the world of investing, you know. And I think that's probably the big lesson to take away. And, you know, John Hempton what was he called them, scumbags, but they're, you know, scumbags that throw off a lot of cash flow or something to that effect, you know. He wasn't wrong about it, you know. Is it cynical? Sure, but, you know, it's probably true.
I was just reading one of the articles, one of the blog posts that he made in 2013. I want to read it to you, and I want to get your reaction. Just a couple points. So back in 2013, when he had called the company scumbags, and it really seemed like he understood the short case very well. I mean, John's not a stupid guy, you know, and he's been similarly critical of other MLM companies like Nu Skin. I think he understands exactly how this fucking company works, to be honest with you. And I have a theory that, and this is all just speculation, but in 2013, when he had that major attitude change from being like, well, it's a, you know, the company's a bunch of scumbags, but they spout off a lot of cash, to a couple months later saying they're a highly ethical company and a national treasure, I think something got to him. I think something changed. I'd be interested to see if he took on certain investors in his fund at that time. I would be interested to see if he had conversations with people that were involved, if he was close to Steeritz, if he was close to Icon. All just speculation, but something definitely changed. So I want to read you something that he wrote in 2013 in a blog post that he put up after visiting a nutrition club in Queens. And there's five statements here, and I want to get your reaction to them. This is right around the same time that he went on CNBC and called the company scumbags. So here's five excerpts from his blog post visiting a nutrition club in Queens. This was the first time I had drunk a protein shake. I can tell you they suck. So does the tea, for that matter. This stuff tastes unbelievably bad. It is flat out gross. That's number one.
Sounds like a judgment to me.
Number two, like Alcoholics Anonymous, it has millions of members and looks, at least externally, a bit like a cult. Number three, Herbalife, like Alcoholics Anonymous, has millions of members because it works. It does not work because one nutrition powder is better than another. Indeed, some nutritionists argue soy-based powders are inferior. Here's number four. The biggest difference that I can see between Alcoholics and Anonymous and Herbalife is that Herbalife is emphatically a for-profit institution and possibly quite an exploit, and possibly quite an exploitive for-profit institution, whereas AA is just a club. Statement four is, Bill Ackman spends most of his presentation arguing that Herbalife's product is the business opportunity. He argues, for instance, that most of the product is sold to distributors. This was clearly true in the Herbalife club I visited. Almost every customer was also a distributor. Which, that I think sums it up right there. I mean, he's calling the company a pyramid scheme without calling it a pyramid scheme, right? And the fifth statement is, but this is really not a story about Herbalife. Herbalife will survive globally. Like all multi-level marketing schemes, it will have its ups and downs. There will be all sorts of problems, such as tax compliance throughout the scheme, cash handling, and perhaps even using Herbalife accounts to launder money. So those are statements that Hempton made in 2013, and to be honest with you, the John Hempton of January 2013 pretty much nails it. I mean, he recognizes all the problems at the company, he points them out, and he says, look, it generates so much cash, it's not going to fucking matter. And the truth is, there, he's right kind of on the moral case and also on the investment case. Now this whole argument that they're an ethical company and also the stock's gone up, he's obviously still been right on the investment, but I disagree with him on the moral case. What's your reaction to those statements?
What's my reaction? You know, a lot of it's rhetoric, right? I mean, you know, you get an array of opinions on the morality of the enterprise. I mean, obviously, Carl Icahn said something to the effect of they employ lots of people, right? I mean, Hempton said they're a national – or no, Bill Steeritz said they're a national treasure.
Yeah, Steeritz said it first, and then Hempton echoed
it. I've lost track of my septuagenarians. You know, it's you know, people talk their book, right? So they're gonna say – whatever supports their particular investment thesis. I don't think there's any surprise about that. You know, many of the articles I wrote were obviously polemic in nature. And that's what you do when you're trying to fuel an argument, you know. So, you know, Hempton was obviously long the stock, and so he's going to talk his book. So, you know, is there anything particularly unique or insightful about what he said that, you know, the average Joe on the street couldn't conclude? Probably not. So, you know, at the end of the day, the FTC has intervened in the United States and forced the company to make sure that whatever canisters of shake mix are being sold to end users. You know, otherwise the incentive system is not allowed to distribute cash. So, you know, they've intervened in an effort to legitimize the sales channel. You know, I don't really follow it that closely anymore at a granular level, but changes have obviously been made to both the law and its enforcement.
Well, we've seen the impact that it's had on North American distributors, and pretty much many of the key data points across the board are down, still trending lower. You know, net income is still trending lower. Free cash flow is still trending lower. Worldwide volume points is still trending lower. All the while, the stock has, you know, pretty much doubled from when the FTC came down and made their decision. So you think the FTC order is going to have teeth and is going to be followed through on? Or do you think this is it? Nobody looks at it again and it's just, it's over.
Well, I would assume that, you know, I don't necessarily believe in the efficiency of capital markets, but I think that any time there's an arbitrage opportunity of some kind, somebody will try to take advantage of it. So I would assume that investors, both long and short, will continue to make this company and others like it accountable. You know, it's important to remember that the operating results of the company are one thing, and the financial engineering that is taking place in the secondary markets are quite another. You know, I mean, obviously the company has been retiring stock at a very aggressive rate, has levered the balance sheet to do so. A large block of the shares remain closely held in Icahn Enterprises' hands. This obviously impacts the liquidity of the security in the secondary market. And, you know, the more scarce the stock is, you know, simple economic analysis, supply and demand is going to have an impact on the multiple that the stock trades at, you know. But those are all probably short-run dynamics. You know, at the end of the day, the present value of the security will be the, you know, the cash flow that is the company produces discounted back into today's dollars. So the company's still going to have to perform to justify the price that secondary market investors are now paying for the security.
Yeah, I know. Do you think Carl Icahn ever really understood this business or the company at all? Aside from the fact that it generated cash and Bill Ackman was on the other side of the trade?
You know, I think, look, to be fair, both Mr. Ackman and Mr. Icahn are obviously extremely successful individuals with long histories of success as investors. I mean, they're not billionaires by accident. Now, they're also human beings. I think both of them would readily admit that in their investing history, they have a portfolio of mistakes that they've made. You know, it's easy to point at Herbalife as one that didn't work out for Mr. Ackman. Blockbuster Video, as I recall, was not the best idea that Mr. Icahn had in his investing life. But, you know, if you want to hit home runs, you have to be prepared to strike out every now and then. That's the nature of the investing process. You know, you can't step out on the ball field without getting dirty, you know? So, what was your original question again?
Oh, Christ. I don't know. I have no clue.
So, you know, I mean,
My original question was whether or not you think Carl Icahn, who, you know, publicly...
Yeah, I think he's a very smart guy. He saw a stock under pressure that was cratering because of a presentation that somebody else had made. He did some due diligence on it. He realized it was trading at a ridiculous multiple, and he took a position in the stock. And my sense of it is that his tenacity as it applied to the trade probably amplified after the infamous tete-a-tete that took place on CNBC between the two of them. You know, I mean, that I think that made it personal, you know. And so, you know, look, these guys are alpha males. They want to win, you know. It's part of their personality to want to win. And, you know, it's been interesting watching it play out over the number of years that it has, you know.
Is it bothersome that, to me, I mean, it still feels like, I mean, I just wrote an article a couple weeks ago on the valuation of the company now, and everything that you're saying is right. The reduction in the amount of shares that are outstanding, the tightly, you know, the fact that it's very tightly held, the fact that, you know, there probably was definitely a short squeeze in play. All these kind of reasons that the stock went up aside from the actual business growing. And to me, I mean, I still feel like, and granted, in fairness, I've felt like this for the last 4 years, but I still feel like at some point the company will have to pay the piper. And I don't know whether that's going to be a fall off in distributors, or whether it's going to be affiliated monitors stepping in, or whether it's going to be something else. I know that, you know, Michael Johnson is out of the way now, and John DeSimone has, I think, left his position as well. But I, you know, it's like the analogy you gave me once when you're walking through the woods in one direction and you have a dog that's running to the left and to the right of the path that you're on. I feel like, but, you know, always kind of winds up reverting to the mean. I feel like now with the way that the equity is priced, with the leverage on the balance sheet, with the, you know, all these outstanding tax liabilities, with all of the, with the valuation where it is, and really the disconnect between the fundamentals and the valuation has arguably never been more out of skew. So, I mean, I can't tell you how many times me and you have had conversations over the last 3 years where we've literally said to each other, I don't think there's ever been a better time to be short the company.
There's never been a better time to join Herbalife, right? Is that, yeah, there's a spin on that, right?
But, yeah. Like, we've said that more than once, and it wasn't because we were trying to play to each other's cognitive dissonance. It was because we really felt that way. And I don't know, to me, you can call me a fool, but I still feel the same way now.
Yeah, well, I think objectively speaking, you know, whenever you're looking at any company, you want to look at the quality of earnings, you know, and I, you know, Warren Buffett obviously is one of the greatest investors in the history of humanity. And, you know, one of the things he used to always say that I always got a kick out of was when he owned shares in Gillette before they were taken out by Procter & Gamble, he used to say, I take a tremendous amount of comfort from knowing that billions of men wake up every morning and shave. You know?
Right.
And at the end of the day, you know, no matter what company you're talking about, free cash flow and earnings are built up from the activity that takes place at the customer level, you know. And so when you look at a business like Coca-Cola or Gillette or any of these extremely high quality consumer products companies, the behavior at the consumer level is extremely compelling because these people are loyal, they're repeat customers, they're lifetime customers. The cash flow streams that get generated at the customer level are extremely valuable, and that's really where the brand equity is measurable, is,
right,
is at the customer level. And, you know, you think about some of these brands are so powerful, they function intergenerationally, you know.
Right, right. Yep.
You know, my dad, you know, my dad and I had a Coke together, you know, and watching a ball game when I was 10 years old. I mean, like, psychologically speaking, these are extraordinarily powerful dynamics. So when I, you know, when I looked at Herbalife, you know, one of the things that struck me as obvious is this is not a company that has high quality earnings. You know, this is a company that has extraordinary amounts of churn in the customer base. Many customers are lucky if they last a year. And so for a company that argues that it's now what do they call themselves now? Herbalife Nutrition.
Yeah.
Objectively speaking, the evidence just doesn't support the claim that they're an extraordinary consumer brand. You know, they're not. The way the company overwhelms that truth is with their recruiting algorithm, which is extremely effective, you know. But it's not a company that I would look at and say, A, I want to be long, and B, I want to pay a premium multiple analogous to other premium consumer products companies, because at the end of the day, when I look at the behavior of the customers, they quit.
Right. And that's what's astonishing, is the fact that the valuation of the company now is on a par with a valuation of, you know, throw a dart, General Mills, or like you're saying, Procter & Gamble. I mean, there's a huge difference between the fact that, you know, I've been using Skippy peanut butter my whole life. Why? Because my mother used to put Skippy peanut butter on my sandwiches. So now when I go to the supermarket, I buy Skippy peanut butter, right? And there's a million examples like you've brought up of brand equity like that. And there's a million people in a million different examples that you can kind of construct of the same type of brand loyalty. And in this case, you have just the opposite, right? You have a model that is reliant on people that come in and then leave. And there's certainly probably been a subsect of these people that have used the brand for a long amount of time, right? Doran Andre or...
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, to be fair, there are lots of businesses out there that, you know, don't have this repeat purchase behavior. I mean, the obvious one would be the funeral service industry. You know, you get the customer once. So, you know, you might get the family member too, but, you know, as a general rule, the customer is only buying once, you know. So, other examples might be selling diamond engagement rings, but, you know, you tend to see extremely high gross margins in some of those businesses. Certainly when I worked in a retail business in Canada, I remember the gross margins on diamond rings were obscene. So it's not that you can't generate earning streams from these kinds of behaviors. It's just that they're obviously not, as compelling or as attractive as those cash flow streams that are generated from repeat and loyal behavior.
Yeah, no, I think you're 100% right.
You know, and at the end of the day, Herbalife's cash flow stream is one thing. How investors want to capitalize it is another. How long Icon Enterprises stays around to continue to financially engineer this company is another question.
What do you think Carl will do?
Well,
to guess. I mean, because I would have told you three times over the last 2 years that, you know, he's not going to get a better price. It's time to sell. And here I am with the stock at split adjusted $111 saying the same exact thing. So what do you think Carl will do?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day...
And how does he exit?
Well, that's the great question. I don't think it's easy, and I don't think it's obvious, you know. but look, on paper at least, he's got enough downside protection at the moment that even if the stock were to sell off on news that he was liquidating, he's still going to walk away with a very profitable investment. So, you know,
Yeah, what do you think?
And you know, it's important to remember that, you know, secondary market securities, there's one of the greatest fallacies you hear is, oh, money's coming into the market, money's coming out of the market. Well, it's not how it works, right? I mean, the company issues a public offering or secondary offering, and then the security itself trades in the secondary market. Mr. Icahn wants to liquidate. Somebody else has to be there to buy it. That's how it works. The same, you know, the number of shares doesn't change unless they're retired by the Treasury, which is, of course, what the company is doing now, you know. So, you know, if I had to guess, I mean, as long as the company's going to continue to throw off $400 to $500 million in free cash flow annually, they'll continue to use that money to reduce the share count. You know, I mean, obviously at this price, what they're paying is very expensive. You know, I can't imagine the IRR on the stock that they're buying in today is compelling.
It can't be. I mean, but again, we've been saying that for 3 years.
You well, know? I mean, look,
I don't know why anybody, including the company to narrow the share structure down, would want to buy the stock here.
The short run in investing feels like the long run until something dramatic happens. You know, I mean, if one of the guys I read religiously is a guy named John Hussman, who is an extremely intelligent man, who's studied market cycles and valuations throughout the course of the history of the stock market. And, you know, not only would you argue that Herbalife is probably very expensive security at the moment, but the general marketplace for stocks is very expensive, relative to history. So, time will sort it out. You know, it always does.
Right.
It always will, you know. But you can look super dumb, and it can be super painful in the short run, you know, defined as, what, 5 to 10 years, if you want to call the short run that, or you can call it 5 to 10 minutes, as some day traders do. You know, it just depends on your perspective.
What do you think the purpose of this stock split is? Because I have two theories. I'll give you both of them real quick. One is that lowering the price might create a little bit more liquidity despite the reduction in the, you know, absolute share count, number one, and that liquidity could ostensibly be used to help somebody like an Icahn exit. Number two is that, you know, why does any company split their stock? It doesn't change the valuation of the stock. It makes it look cheaper, even though the market cap stays the same, right?
Well, I think the effect of stock splits is largely psychosomatic, although...
Is what?
You know, psychosomatic. It's you know, it's irrelevant. I mean, the only thing that you can say is, if you look at the Berkshire Hathaway A share and the Berkshire Hathaway B shares, to a retail investor, you know, obviously a split share with a lower nominal price makes it practical for them to buy shares into their account. But for an institutional investor, you know, whether the stock is 111 or 55 on a 2-for-1 split, I mean, it should be irrelevant. The amount of capital these people have to throw around, it really makes no difference.
Yeah, so you just think they just did it just for the psychology?
Well, I think there's just a long pattern of this sort of thing in the world of investment banking. You know, once stocks trade over $100 a share, we try to bring them back down into double digits, you know, because they become more marketable to our client base, you know. But other than that, the earnings per share, the aggregate cash flow of the company, the aggregate valuation of the company, nothing should change.
Right, of course. Did you look at the company's last quarter that they reported?
I didn't look at it too closely. I mean, I gather the China numbers were down.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about.
That seemed to be something to do with a price increase or something. You know, they always have an explanation for why the results are, you know, what companies like to say, well, lumpy results, you know. So I didn't look at it all that closely, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I find it fascinating that when you try to narrow down that the underlying kind of legacy health of the business to net income, to you can even look at balance sheet leverage, to cash flow, and to volume points, which is really the purest way to gauge the business, all things being equal, as long as the company doesn't change what a volume point is, that these things have just kind of trended lower over time. And, you know,
certainly within the numbers, I think you see different customer behavior in different geographies. You know, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the European market has been more resilient for them than, say, Latin America. You know, Mexico has been down, but seems to have stabilized. The United States has obviously gone through a significant transition. The larger markets tend to be more resilient. The larger the population base in these countries, the more opportunity the company seems to have to recruit. But notwithstanding that, there's certainly evidence in the data that shows extremely volatile results in given geographies, you know, where you get like double digit drops in revenues year over year. You know, the bottom line is, you know, the 10Qs are measuring all of this customer activity quarter over quarter over quarter, and the narrative continues to reveal that the incentive system that the company presents to the world continues to be able to successfully recruit new people into the value proposition. So
you feel like at some point as a human race, we're going to have to evolve and realize that these style of companies they're just not worth it. They're just not worth getting involved in. I mean, it's fascinating to me that the industry exists.
The answer is no.
In general, right? The fact that the multi-level marketing industry exists is really, you know, indicative of the fact that the people that are getting involved with them don't really generally have too much financial sophistication. Generally, I'm making a general statement. I mean, the people at the top might, and there's a limited number of people who may find success when they get in early. But all of the people that are churning through the bottom of the company, whether it's Nu Skin, whether it's Advocare, whether it's Vima, whether it's LuLaRoe, whether it's Rodin and Fields, you know, the bottom number of people that continue to churn in and out is a result of really, I think, not having an understanding of how the odds are stacked against you. You know, even like Mary Kay, I mean, has been around for forever. You don't think that at some point, you know, one of these companies will be made an example of, and that this business model will eventually either go away, if not through regulation, just through human evolution? I mean,
no. Well, I think the answer is no. I mean, because again, you know, I'm going to get a little philosophical on you here, but
do it,
to
man.
Me, the great, you know, if you want to identify a tremendous tension within humanity, to me, it's the tension between, you know, the scientific method, enlightenment, reason, evidence, dialectics, what have you, and, you know, superstition, faith, nonsense, whatever you want to call it. The continuum, and the bridge between the two is what people call the world of philosophy, right? Philosophy is the love of wisdom. Now, mankind has made tremendous advances over the last 2,000 years plus, just credulous species to a species that is enlightened. But let's be blunt about it. There's still work to be done, you know? And one of the things that, true, you know, you talk about P.T. Barnum and every cloud has a silver lining is, you know, there are marketers out there who recognize the fallibility and the delusion inherent in our species. And they design incentive systems to appeal to that truth, right? Now, you, whether that's religion, whether that's a blackjack table at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, whether that's the cosmetics counter at Bloomingdale's, you know, you can identify all kinds of offerings to human beings that have no real provable value, objectively speaking, and yet there's a lot of customers, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who sign up for this, you know, this sort of stuff. And much as I would love it if we were ubiquitously a more rational species, the fact of the matter is we aren't. And maybe that's the big takeaway from the Herbalife story is Bill came in with a very well-researched, objectively supported argument, you know, and ultimately faith won.
Yeah. You know? So you do not watch Long Island Medium, I take it?
I don't. I don't know what that is.
It's a woman from Long Island who has convinced everybody that she has supernatural powers and that she can talk to the dead.
I mean, just the word supernatural in and of itself is a dead giveaway, right?
And like she has
we're talking outside of the natural order. Something could be wrong there, you know.
Let me just tell you about this show.
It's like a superhero. Like, the guy's so heroic, he's like bigger than a hero. You know, I mean, but we love this nonsense, because at the end of the day, we're a very insecure species. And, you know, if you're somebody who's in the lower quartile of the socioeconomic ladder, and somebody comes up to you dressed like Susan Peterson or John Tartle and tells you, or Doran Andre, or all these other disgraceful human beings.
Entrepreneurs.
No, these people are disgraceful human beings. You know, I mean, John DeSimone is, look, as a member of humanity, he's just a disappointment to me. But, you know, but the bottom line is there are people who are like, how can I become like you? You know, how can I become like you? But at the end of the day, the incentive system is rigged the same way a blackjack table in Las Vegas is rigged. You know, on a short run basis, can you beat the house? Sure you can. But on a long run basis, the odds of the game are stacked so that the house wins.
Yeah, but you don't understand, Matt. I have a system. I have a blackjack. Yeah. I have a blackjack system. I have a slot machine system.
Yeah,
I figured it out. I have a system for playing the lottery.
You
just don't get it.
Well, you should come to my casino then, because I'm going to give you free drinks and let you play your system all night long. In fact, I'll set up a table with Allen Iverson for you. How about that?
Oh, that'll be great. Maybe I can get to watch him piss in a trash can in real life instead of just hearing about it on the news.
You and your Philadelphia homies.
You know, one of the things that me and you used to laugh about all the time was when they would have these extravaganzas. This just goes back to your point that you were just making, but one of the things that me and you used to fucking just crack up about, and I'm not even joking, man, there were times when we would be on the phone where I couldn't fucking breathe. I was laughing so hard because we would talk about this until we were blue in the face, and usually we would just fixate on some piece of stupidity or absurdity, and you know, you could posthumously look back and say we were laughing while we were getting crushed on the trade, which I guess would be funny if you're a counterparty. So if you're listening and you're a counterparty, I hope you take some joy in that. But aside from that,
yeah, no, here's what I would say, Chris. We were generally right, but specifically wrong. How about that?
That's good. But one of the things that we used to just die about, and I just remember laughing. I couldn't breathe. I was laughing so hard. Was Des Walsh signing autographs at these extravaganzas. And I remembered you saying to me at one point, like, who would want Des Walsh's autograph? Like, who is he? Like, is he the Pope?
If you like Lucky Charm cereal, you would definitely want it.
No. Don't go ad hominem, all right? let's try to avoid that, all right? But just the concept
to me it's totally fair game to caricature these people, you know, notwithstanding the fact that they've all earned, you know, lots of money running this algorithm around the world since Mark Hughes, whenever he initiated it. You know, it's totally fair game to lampoon and caricature these people. Because at the end of the day, you know, their behavior isn't moral.
Well, and it's certainly not normal either. I just want to go back to the autographs for a second. Wait, I want you to tell me what is going through the mind of a person that is reaching up to a stage and asking for Des Walsh's autograph. What is going through the head of a person like that? What do they do? What do you do with Des Walsh's autograph once you get it?
What do you do with Des Walsh's autograph? That's a, wow. If you run out of toilet paper, I suppose.
What is going, like, forget about the fact that these people are at an extravaganza, right? Which is pretty much an event just to, in my opinion, just to kind of strengthen a psychological hold that this company has on its members, and also to generate some money, too, some would argue. But then to be the person that's, you know, standing at the front of the barrier like they're at a Nickelback concert.
Sure, but I mean, at the end of the day, I guess the truth is a matter of perspective. I mean, I'll give you a specific example, right? So I'm the person who I'm not a person who likes violence, violence against man, violence against animals. You know, I'm not a hunter. I'm not, you know, so this whole world of mixed martial arts to me, I don't enjoy it.
But
if you watch the people in the crowd at these events, you know, they're obviously enjoying it. You know, to me, it's a very there's something very disturbing about, you know, people getting into a frenzy watching two other human beings literally try to maim one another, you know. But that's not the truth for everybody, you know. And so I think in like manner, the people who go to these extravaganzas and get inside these rooms and get all whipped up into a frenzy and, you know, when you're not part of it and you're sort of divorced from it and you have some perspective on it, you reach a different conclusion than you do when you're in the room, you know. And of course, this is the very nature of propaganda, you know. I mean, and this is why living in America is a great thing, because people like you and me have the right to call out hucksters like Des Walsh and criticize them freely, you know, provided that we're using evidence to do so.
I think it was Rocky that said, you know, of course, typical fucking Philadelphian, but I think it was Rocky that said, what's so crazy about standing toe to toe with somebody saying I am, you know?
Yeah.
But you know what's funny? Let's talk about MMA just for a second. It's completely off topic, but I go to jiu-jitsu, right? And I actually was there this morning, and there is, I think the case for MMA is that there is a technical side to what's going on in the ring, similar to boxing. There's a science to it. There's a very technical side to it.
Oh, you mean like there's a skill? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Oh, there absolutely is.
And that they have to be athletic.
What do you mean?
The participants are tremendous athletes.
Yeah, they're athletic, but there's also a, it's a very technical, like when you watch a fight, and I'll just give you a perfect example. I mean, years
ago. Sure, but the strategic objective of the Enterprise is to try to inflict harm on your opponent.
Sure.
Correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, that at the end of the day.
Let's
throw Christians and lions together again. Yeah.
Yeah, but let me argue with you on this because, you know, I know you're really into hockey, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, aren't there some principles in hockey that are very similar
to MMA?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree.
No, I don't think the strategic objective of ice hockey teams is to inflict concussions and
bloodletting
on their opponent.
You ever watch Daniel Carcillo play hockey?
Well, you know, have there been players in the history of the game who have behaved that way? Absolutely, but you know, again, speaking about, you know, superstition versus enlightenment, I mean, credit to the game of hockey, they are moving closer to the truth, right? Which is, the scientific evidence is such that if two 240-pound men stand across from one another and, you know, beat their heads in with their fists, you know, odds are, you know, that somebody's going to get a concussion. And the more concussions they get, the more likely they might be to die.
Right. So
maybe this isn't such a good idea anymore. Well, and credit where credit is due, one of the biggest old school, let's call him a curmudgeon if you like, in the game of hockey,
Goons.
Mike Milbury, who played for the Big Bad Bruins, openly stated it's time to get fighting out of the game, you know, so.
Yeah, but they haven't, and I don't think they ever.
No, but the statistical evidence is that it's dropping significantly, and there are arguments being made that it's just a matter of time. But, you know, as with many things in life, things don't turn on a dime. I mean, it took a long time for this country to get rid of slavery. It took a long time for this country to grant women the right to vote. It
right.
took a long time for same-sex marriage to be acknowledged, you know, and we're now, you know, with this shooting in Santa Fe this week, another heartbreaking, senseless loss of life. We the people who are responsible for this republic now have to answer important questions about what kind of country do we want to live in moving forward, right? And this is the way democracy works, you know? And so whether you or I are proven correct on Herbalife as an investment doesn't neutralize the importance of our role or Bill's role or any other muckraker for that matter in participating in our democracy to make sure that, you know, we're striving to become a more moral, ethical, and just nation.
So you don't think similarly, though, as you're saying, right? They're going to phase out fighting in hockey. You hope that there will be, you know, gun reform in the country to prevent these shootings. You don't think similarly we will either regulate or legislate out multi-level marketing companies, or we will eventually move on from them? You don't think the harm being done there is tangible enough, or what?
I mean, you know, I think it's naive to conclude that legislation in and of itself is effective. You know, I mean, I had a history teacher in high school who used to always say to us, you know, you can't legislate people's attitudes. So you can outlaw slavery, but you can't get rid of racism per se, right? But what happens, I think, as a species is over time, there's a shift where it's no longer politically palatable for you to be in a group of constituents that believes a certain thing, you know? And again, this is philosophical stuff. I mean, look, there were people on this planet who used to think that it was flat
There still are.
There were people on this planet who used to think that, you know, the sun revolved around the Earth. You know, I mean, as a species, we've believed in a lot of nonsensical ideas since we evolved from single cell organisms into who we are today. And interestingly, along those lines, you know, if you look at the history of evolution, what will a human being look like 1,000 years from now? I mean, I don't know what I won't be around, but it's an interesting question, right? But part and parcel of that is man's search for truth, man's search for enlightenment, man's search for answers will continue to push us forward as a people. And the, you know, the greatest way we move forward is by having MMA type arguments, you know, using sure. facts and getting to the bottom of things. And it's a messy process, and it's often an extremely emotional process, right? I mean, you look at these young students who are walking to rallies to protest the violence that's occurring in their schools. I mean, there's extreme emotion that's being expressed here, but this is how we jump forward. This is how we move forward, right? Now, I mean, do MLMs evoke the same kind of visceral responses? Doubtful. You know, but they're just an example of activity that takes place in the underbelly of the country that, you know, all things being equal, you would prefer didn't occur.
Right. And there's a good argument to be made there, too, and one of the other out of many questions that has to be debated and tossed around time and time again is how much regulation is too much, and how much should liberty versus regulation, I think, comes in also too. And some of what I thought were points that resonated a little bit more than others with me, you know, politically I'm somewhat of a libertarian, where you know, these people are just running a business, and if people are going to get ripped off, then just let them get ripped off. It's not the government's job to come in and regulate every single thing. And while I don't necessarily agree with it in the case of MLMs, because I think that they're inherently a fallacy, I can at least try to see it from that perspective, too. To translate that to your MMA arguments, like if two guys want to get together and beat the shit out of each other, then, you know...
Well, I mean, look, I mean, if you look at the history of the world, capitalism works. I mean, in the sense that if you give a capitalist a for-profit motive, they will do whatever they can to extract as much profit as they can right. out of whatever business activity they're going to engage in, including things like importing slaves from Africa, having children work in factories. You know, there's always somebody at the bottom of the food chain that the capitalist will take advantage of. Well, as a society, you know, people figured out a long time ago, wait a second, what the robber barons are doing here, it seems a little over the top, you know? And that's where you ended up with collective bargaining and, you know, ideas like employment insurance and social security and what have you. You know, now I'm not arguing in favor of one or the other, libertarian versus not.
Sure.
What I'm saying is that there's a natural tension that exists within our species where, you know, people are naturally on opposite sides of an issue and they wrestle it out and ultimately find some kind of equilibrium. You know, that's how the law works, right? I mean, we've decided as a species that four-way stop signs are a good idea. Now, would I love to blow through a stop sign and continue on my way? Yes, I would. But, you know, if the guy coming from the other direction thinks the same thing, then the then our mutually assured destruction is inevitable, right? So we've concluded that it's in my best interest and in his or her best interest to give up a little bit of our individual freedom so that we don't cause harm to one another. And this seems to be a logical boundary for freedom, is when my freedom starts to harm you as a person,
right?
You know, then your freedom is being imposed upon, right?
Sure, yep.
And that's the law, right? Now, is it always a bright line? Of course not. You know, a capital punishment versus not, abortion versus not, same-sex marriage versus not, gun control versus not. These are very emotional issues, but we have a process in this republic to work through them and to try to get to the bottom of them and to try to figure them out, you know. And really, the Herbalife story is just a microcosm of that process, right? You had a company that's been operating seemingly undisturbed for a very long time, and Bill Ackman decided, hey, I'm going to shine a light on this thing, because what I'm seeing going on here, it just doesn't seem quite right to me, you know? And, you know, whether or not he was successful on the investment side, from a societal perspective, I mean, he has to be able to claim some victory. I mean, to me, there's just no doubt about that.
What do you, just to go off Herbalife and start to kind of bring things to a conclusion here, what are you looking at now from an investing perspective? So I guess tell me a little bit about how you were invested in Herbalife, as much as you want to, obviously.
Yeah,
don't have to
I'm
get
paying
into
down.
Details. And then
paying down my mortgage. I'm looking to invest in my children's education. I'm looking to invest in their human capital. And other than that, quite frankly, you know, the capital markets seem extremely stretched to me. I mean, does that mean you can't, you know, I mean, all investments should be evaluated really on a bottom up basis, but, it seems to me that earning streams are being capitalized at very expensive rates. And,
you were short the Russell some years back, right?
That tends not to work out well. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure what a large percentage of the companies in the Russell 2000 don't even generate any free cash flow. So it's difficult to capitalize those earning streams. And as for the rest of them, I'm pretty sure they're a couple standard deviations away from their historical average. But
so you don't have
wiser minds than me can figure that out.
You don't have an investment right now that you are looking at, or that you're considering, or that you've, you know, you don't have anything on the capital market side that has piqued your interest of late?
Yeah, I haven't really been actively involved in the stock market for a little bit at the moment.
You think you will return to Seeking Alpha at some point and start to write, whether it's about Herbalife or whether it's about something else? I mean, I talked to a bunch of people just today after I said that you were coming on the podcast that were telling me that they enjoyed reading your stuff. I personally want to know, for my own edification, will you come back and ever, you know, start writing again? I loved your style.
Well, that's nice of you to say. I think for me, you know, if I have an issue that
moves the needle,
gets me motivated, then I will write about it. You know, I mean, gosh, I'd love to write an essay on this shooting this week in Santa Fe, but that really doesn't have anything to do with money. Yeah, never say never, right?
Yeah. All right, Matt. Well, listen, man, thanks so much for coming on. I'm glad that I asked you again today after you told me like 2 months ago that you didn't want to come on. And I just kind of asked you randomly today, like, hey, you want to do this? And I must have just caught you at a good time because you said yes. So I'm glad I did. That's my tactic, just pester people until they eventually give in.
Yeah, well, I will say this. I think, you know, whether your arguments or my arguments are ultimately successful, after we're dead, there's an awfully long time to be quiet. So I think it's important that people who feel like they want to be part of the democratic process should jump forward and speak their mind, you know? And if somebody disagrees with you or me, they should be equally free to come back and say, look, I think your argument is nonsense and here's why. In this particular scenario, you have to give credit to Mr. Icahn where credit is due. Did he defeat all of Mr. Ackman's arguments? Obviously not. But in the particular metric, which was return on invested capital, you have to give him the
sure.
You know, you got to give him his kudos, right?
Sure, absolutely. All right, Matt. Well, thanks a lot for coming on, man. I appreciate it, and it's good to hear your voice. I think a lot of other people will think the same, and hopefully we can catch up again at some point soon.
All right, Chris, take care.
All right, talk to you later. All right, that was Matt Stewart. Matt, again, started writing about Herbalife some years back, was one of my favorite people to read on Seeking Alpha. If you want to go back and read posthumously some of his research, which factually, again, I believe to be 100% on the money. Of course, we know how the trade worked out against us, but I still believe Matt to be not only a good writer and a quick wit, but also a very smart guy. So it was awesome talking to him, and hope it was informative for some people that have been asking me for a little while to see if I could get him on. Before I jet, I do one more time want to remind everybody listening that today's podcast was brought to you by Series7Podcast.com. That's Series, the number 7, Podcast.com. And again, I think this is really cool. You don't have to really be a financial professional to want to take the Series 7 practice test or learn about what's on the Series 7. You can always just go and inform yourself. And Series7Podcast.com and the gentleman Franz that runs it, they make that available to you. Successful investing, again, is a result of experience, education, and luck. You can't rush experience. You can't control luck, but you can definitely educate yourself. And if you ever go to work in the financial services industry, obviously you may be required to pass the Series 7, which again covers the material financial professionals are required to master before they can talk to the general public about investments. But again, the knowledge shouldn't only be for financial professionals. Franz, again, at Series7Podcast.com, he's put together an audio course to help financial professionals and individual investors master the material for the Series 7. It covers the full gamut of financial products and regulations, including the various equities such as common preferred, convertible stocks, fixed income securities, closed and open-end mutual funds, warrants, options, defined contribution, defined benefit retirement plans, and on and on and on and on, and everything you could possibly need to know to make yourself a financial expert and impress your friends at parties. The cool thing is Franz lets you try before you buy. You can get 5 free sample lessons. You go to his website. It's series7podcast.com. Sign up for the free sample lessons and related quizzes, or you can subscribe to the podcast and download the lessons from his podcast. The full course, again, it's 58 audio lessons. It's over 25 hours of instruction and over 1,100 online quiz questions. If you want to purchase the lessons and quizzes bundle before July 1st, which is 12 days, if you want to purchase it, you can get $10 off. Just use the offer code RAVEN, all lowercase, R-A-V-E-N, at checkout. And again, that's all at series7podcast.com. So go on over, give Franz a shout, and you know what? Franz was cool enough to be one of the first people to reach out for me and offer me a sponsorship. And for that, I thank him very much. And if you want to support me, it would be awesome if you could go over and check out his stuff. Another thing, too, is I just want to say thank you to a couple people that have hit me up on Patreon. I took the time to write something to people that offer to donate on Patreon. When you commit to a recurring monthly contribution, whether it's $1 or $10 or $100 or 50 cents, there's a little note that gets sent out from me. And I took a lot of time to write that and to sit down and say exactly what I wanted to say to people that were kind enough to go on there and help me out. And so I got a couple new Patreons over the last couple days, and I just sincerely want to say thank you for that. It's very much appreciated. You know, Quote the Raven Research LLC, which is my company, the podcast, the things that I do generates very, very nominal amounts of revenue. I do it mostly so that I have a place where I can just speak from and speak my mind. And you guys help out, and I really appreciate that so much. So that was Matt Stewart. I'm Quote the Raven. I'm getting out of here. I'm going down to Philly. If you guys see me in Center City tonight, smack me on the ass and buy me a beer. All right? Peace.